the Richmond Theatre outside of London. Although Dad initially resisted cutting the rock and roll scene, and Brendan reportedly cried because he thought it was some of his best work, in the end, my dad trusted the audience and made the substitution. Ultimately, this change did not save Bedazzled from the lackluster response it garnered from critics and theatergoers. In this case, my dad could not have cared less. He believed so strongly in the message of the movie and in the performances by the actors that he was honestly impervious to the critique and general indifference Bedazzled received. I really enjoyed the movie, but thought it could have been more interesting if it were a little edgier and less on the nose. Watching the movie again recently, I was touched by Brendan's portrayal of Elliot's longing and snickered at the misfires of his wishes, but still felt that something about the slickness of the production and the unrelenting sincerity of the characters ended up detracting from the power of the film's important message. If I can make it there. Like many recent college graduates, when I finished at UC Santa Cruz, I was full of ideals and was all fired up, ready to get out there and make a difference. The wonderful comedian Lotus Weinstock, a dear friend of my mom's, once said, "I used to want to save the world. Now I just want to leave the room with some dignity." I toyed with the idea of making political documentaries, but my aversion to the entertainment business made this a difficult leap. The Hollywood life I had been exposed to seemed way too superficial for me. I grew up seeing the type of people that were successful in the film industry, and they mostly seemed like people I didn't want to be around. Since I wasn't pretty enough to be in front of the camera or ambitious enough to be behind it, I knew I had to find my own niche. Just after graduation, Danny, not her real name, a woman I had befriended at UCSC, told me she was going to graduate school at NYU and asked if I was interested in sharing an apartment in Brooklyn. Already leaning toward New York based on my dad's encouragement, I jumped at the opportunity. Even though I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do when I got there, since my dad was willing to help fund the transition, I figured I could just find any old job and work for a while until I figured out my next steps. Privilege, check. The apartment share ended up falling through, though, and my dad and Erica were so terrified that I would end up in Alphabet City, God forbid, that they bought me an apartment in a small co-op on the Upper West Side. At the time, Alphabet City, the east side of the East Village, was still considered scary by some, even though the gentrification process had already begun. Now, all of the burned-out buildings and most of the drug dealers are gone, and the entire neighborhood is owned by NYU and is pretty much unrecognizable. I made the move in September of 1999 and immediately felt at home in New York. I basked in the energy and excitement of the city and was grateful to reconnect with old friends. Ethan and some other people I knew from LA were living in the East Village, and we had fun roaming around the city, smoking, talking, and laughing, just like old times, only better because we were adults now and could go to bars. We played pool at Blue and Gold, danced salsa in the back room of the Parkside Lounge, and took in the sights at Milk Bar before stumbling to Veselka for French fries at 4 a.m. to fortify me for the cab ride back uptown. As cool as the downtown bar scene seemed at the time, I loved the quiet of my tree-lined block and the beauty of Central Park. My friends and I used to say it was our version of upstate. Soon after settling in, I ended up landing work in the nonprofit sector. I stayed in this field for about a year, doing program support, mostly clerical work, and event planning, begging people for donations, for a few different companies. Some of my bosses were clowns, and some of the causes were hopeless, but some of the organizations were doing truly amazing work, and it was a great learning experience for a New York newbie. I basically worked for free, but my dad was supportive of my choices emotionally and financially. "Do what makes you happy, baby," he'd say. "What is all this money for if not to make all of our lives more comfortable?" After a year, I wanted to get back to working with kids and was again considering getting a master's in education. So I got a job as an assistant preschool teacher at the Children's Aid Society in the West Village. September 11th, 2001 was the first day of school and my first day on the job. Dad and Erica had been visiting me and were on their way to the airport to fly back to Chicago. I was getting the classroom ready to welcome the kids and parents when the head teacher and I heard the sound of a plane engine that seemed much too loud. We ran to the window but couldn't see anything. Then the teachers in the corner classroom screamed. We raced over and saw what looked like a small hole in the World Trade Center. As word of what was going on spread, other staff members arrived to take in the view and try to figure out what the hell had just happened. By the time we finished the morning session with the students, around 11 a.m., the second plane had hit, both towers had collapsed, and clearly, none of it was an accident. I started to panic, worried that one of the planes had been my dad's, and I was unable to reach him via cell since all lines were busy. I used the phone at the school to call the house in Chicago, and they told me he had just called and was fine. I was both hysterical and numb at the same time. I didn't know anyone who worked in the World Trade Center, so once I knew my family was okay, it wasn't personal. And yet, it was. Here I was in the city I had fallen in love with, taking care of 12 toddlers, trying to help them feel comfortable and safe as they separated from their parents, and the world was showing me, and everyone else, just how much of an illusion all of that really was. On their way to LaGuardia, Dad and Erica saw the second plane hit from the Queensboro Bridge, and by the time they got to the airport, all air travel had been suspended indefinitely. The airport was pandemonium, and since they had no idea when they might be able to fly out, they commandeered a complete stranger's town car and driver, and the four of them drove to Carroll Gardens to eat Chinese food and watch the news at my college friend Danny's house. Anxious to get home to the boys, my dad and Erica rode with this woman back to her mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut, gave the driver $1,000, and then rented a car and drove 18 hours straight to Chicago. The day was an entirely surreal experience. I got a hysterical message from Ethan telling me he had been doing rooftop landscape work in Tribeca and saw people jumping from the building. I wandered around the West Village, not knowing what to do. I remember seeing people walking around like zombies covered in asbestos dust from the buildings. Sirens wailed from all directions, and doctors and nurses waited outside the ER at St. Vincent's for a rush of patients that never came. The smell in the air is something I'll never forget. It lingered for weeks. Eventually, I walked across the Brooklyn Bridge to Danny's and, not wanting to be alone, stayed there for a few days. On Friday, I went home to my half-renovated apartment upstate on West 87th Street, where the air was clear and, bizarrely, life seemed to go on much as it had before. At the risk of sounding narcissistic in the face of mass tragedy, I felt pretty raw and lost after 9/11. I shared none of the moral outrage or patriotic pride that seemed to be the only two acceptable responses in the country at the time. I just felt small and vulnerable and anxious about the fate of the world, or my world at least. I would make eye contact with strangers on the subway and start crying, thinking about the fragility of life. A few weeks later, Danny and I took mushrooms in my apartment and spent about an hour sobbing before coming up with a beehive analogy for New York City that made us feel better because, hey, we are all connected after all. We may not know what's going on in other parts of the hive, but there are bees and people everywhere going about their business, finding flowers, making honey, and it's all going to be okay. We're not alone. Yay for drugs. Just kidding, kids. In the same way that my father's generation reeled from the assassinations of JFK and then MLK, the effects of 9/11 rippled out from personal loss and grief to national trauma. It may not have made me feel more American, but being so close to the event and living through that day definitely solidified my identity as a New Yorker. Baby on board. A few months later, I got pregnant with my first child. I was 24 and had only known the father, Keith, for about a month. We met through a series of random events that are actually not random at all if you read the Celestine Prophecy in high school like I did. To make a long story short, in the summer of 2001, I was in LA visiting my mom and went to a party at an old friend's house. I took MDMA and met a woman I really liked. Little did I know at the time that she and her husband were trying to pick me up. She and I kept in touch, and I told her she could stay with me anytime she visited New York. That November, she took me up on my offer, and a few days into her visit, introduced me to a group of guys she had met 10 years prior at a club when she was in town for one night on her way to London. Are you feeling the cosmic chills yet? Keith walked into my apartment with three of his friends, a solo cup of Johnny Walker, a cocky attitude, and a beautiful smile. So, of course, I liked him right away. After drinking and listening to music at my apartment, 12 of us piled into two cars and went to Sue's Rendezvous, a strip club in Mount Vernon with the laziest strippers I have ever seen. Keith and I ended up talking the whole night, and I ended up sleeping with him, of course. But he surprisingly came back the next day, and the next, and maybe even the next after that. I liked him, but didn't expect it to turn into anything serious. I'd recently gotten out of an intense relationship and just wanted someone to hang out with, maybe go to a movie with. Simple things. Keith fit the bill perfectly. Keith was a born and bred New Yorker from Washington Heights. Half black and half Italian, but always mistaken for Dominican. Raised with his sister by an eccentric single mom. Worked in food service at a nursing home, where he has been for the past 20 years and counting. Drove a limo on his days off and had dreams of being an actor. I immediately fell for his goofy sense of humor and sweetness, which seemed incongruous with his love of Mobb Deep and motorcycles. He wasn't book smart, he'd dropped out of college after 1 year to help his mom financially, but was practical, organized, and a self-proclaimed king of common sense. We were different in so many ways, but had a strong physical attraction and enjoyed each other's company. After my teenage abortion experience, I decided that, while that had been the right decision for me at the time, I had used my get-out-of-jail-free card once and would not do it again. I gave a little speech to anyone I had questionably protected sex with. Basically, using a condom but not consistently or not for the whole time. We are adults and we should use protection. That being said, if we're not being super careful, we both know what could happen. If I get pregnant, I will not have an abortion, so be warned. When I told Keith this, he said that he totally understood and felt the same way. "So let's have babies," he said. I laughed and blew a smoke ring in his face. When I took a pregnancy test around Christmas and it came back positive, I had stopped laughing. Was I crazy? In spite of the conviction of my little speech and my lifelong desire to have kids, I was terrified and unsure if I was really doing the right thing. I called my mom first, and she got on board right away, bless her heart. She said, "We have two choices in life, Violet. We can choose fear or we can choose love. Everything comes down to that. I happen to know that you were born to be a mother, and I think it's wonderful that you want to do this." My dad wasn't initially supportive, and it was very hard for me. He said I was too young, that I was foolish to embark on the most intense journey of life, parenting, with someone I barely knew. He said I was being unrealistic about how hard it would be to support a family in New York without his help. I was crushed, hurt, angry, betrayed, abandoned. I had hoped that everyone would rally around to support me and my new little family. I was ready to say fuck it and get a side job at McDonald's when my dad started to come around. I remember talking to Erica on the phone, with her serving as the emotional interpreter between me and my dad. "Oh, Violetti, we just want the best for you." "I know, and I appreciate that, but why is your best better than my best? What if this is the best thing for me?" "You know your daddy loves you." "I know." "And he's always been there for you." "I know." "So just ask him for help. Tell him you know this is hard and you understand how he's feeling and you really want his blessing and his help." "You think?" "Yes, I do. I know. I love you so much." "I love you too. Thank you." So, on Erica's advice, I swallowed my pride and decided to ask for help. I invited my dad to come to New York so we could have a few therapy sessions together to figure out where we stood. My dad and I sat on the sad leather couch in the therapist's apartment office, and I took a deep breath and said, "I know this isn't what you wanted for me, but this is what's happening. Your love and support have always been everything to me, and I really hope that you can find a way to be happy for me. If I have to do it on my own, I will, but I don't want to. Will you please help me?" He cried and said he needed a little more time to think about it, but told me how much he loved me and that nothing would ever change that. This breakthrough was followed a couple of days later by a very awkward dinner on my 25th birthday with me, my dad, and Keith at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in Midtown. Keith was understandably very nervous on the way to dinner. He knew how close my dad and I were and was worried about the pregnancies disrupting that. He also knew who my dad was and, as a regular blue-collar guy, felt intimidated by my dad's status. I tried to reassure him that my family wasn't like that and wouldn't judge him. As long as he was a kind, caring, and responsible person, that was all that mattered to them. My dad walked in, hugged me, and shook Keith's hand. By the way he cleared his throat and kept touching his ear, I could tell he was nervous, too. When we sat down, I told them both to have a drink and did my best to keep the conversation easy-breezy. Keith talked about his childhood, his family, his work, and his aspirations. My dad talked about his early jobs and his current pre-production work on Analyze That. When it was time for dessert, I made a big deal about avoiding chocolate because I wanted to show my dad I was taking motherhood seriously and had been reading a horrible pregnancy book that made me scared to eat anything. Key lime pie, my dad suggested. Ice cream? No, I said, pouting. I really wanted cake, but they only have chocolate, and chocolate has caffeine, and caffeine is bad for the baby, so I just won't have anything. Hold on, Keith said with a Cheshire Cat smile, and pulled a mini carrot cake from Carrot Top Pastries out from his backpack. I burst into tears of appreciation and excused myself to go to the bathroom. Looking back over my shoulder, I saw my dad pat Keith on the back and smile. There was no denying that Keith was a good guy, and I breathed a sigh of relief that the ice had been broken and they seemed to be getting along well. By the time Dad was ready to head back to Chicago, he was okay with the situation and said that he and Erica would help me financially so I could stay home with the baby for a while. I was beyond grateful for their help and relieved that I wouldn't have to figure out how to make a minimum wage job stretch to fit New York living with a baby. Keith and I adjusted to our new relationship as we rearranged the apartment, planned baby showers, and took a Lamaze class. It wasn't the typical honeymoon phase of a new romance, although he did give me amazing foot massages every day after work. But we were young and optimistic and quickly settled into a comfortable routine. When my wonderful son Keon was born in August of 2002, my dad had come full circle, requesting to be called Grand Dude and proudly telling his friends that I didn't feel the need to get married, that a baby was enough of a commitment. Jew-ish. Throughout my childhood, we had always gone to my dad's family in Chicago for the Jewish holidays, but in the spring of 2002, I hosted a Passover Seder at my apartment in New York. Without my ever having gone to Hebrew school or practiced any religion at home, the cultural part of Judaism was what really resonated for me. The songs, the stories, the food, the family, and I was excited to recreate some of that old tribal magic. As a kid, I'd loved the rituals of Passover, even though I didn't understand or connect with symbolism. The horseradish representing the bitterness of slavery, haroset for the bricks made by the Hebrew slaves, the little bowls of salt water standing in for the sweat and tears of the Jewish slaves, the four questions. Although I followed no religious conventions in my daily life, it was obvious that night that there was something special, if not sacred, about carrying on these traditions as my ancestors had done for thousands of years. That Passover, Erica, Julian, Daniel, Keith, my friend Danny, and her friend Natalie were there with me to experience the joy of my dad in full-on radical rabbi mode and were treated to the funniest and most thought-provoking religious experience of my life. We had Haggadahs, but we barely looked at them. My dad not only knew every biblical story from memory, he told them in a historical and geopolitical context that had us all scrambling to remember our early civilization education. So-and-so likely lived in which Mesopotamian city? Anyone? Anyone? Uruk, that's right. I can't tell you how many times since then I've wished we recorded that night, but there's one lesson I will always remember. Babies who supposedly got floated down the river in baskets were usually just illegitimate. I'm looking at you, Moses. My dad was not what I would call a religious person, although culturally he strongly identified as Jewish and spiritually more as a Buddhist. As an adult, he studied religion from a historical and political perspective and was able to incorporate what he learned alongside existential philosophy and psychology to form a sort of meta-belief system. He did not believe in God, per se, but was quick to say, "We live in a miraculous world, and it's driven by forces we may never understand. It's awesome, it's mysterious, but I don't give it a name. I don't pretend to understand it or accept that there's some moral code that derives from it that other people know that I don't. I have no problem with God, but making God an entity is not important to me. In Bedazzled, he defined it more succinctly as that universal spirit that animates and binds all things in existence. Dad had the foundation of the Hebrew school training he'd received as a boy, but his eternally curious mind had gone on a deep dive into the origins of theism across the spectrum. "Well," he'd say, "you have your big five, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism. They all involve some form of deity, whether it's the one God, Holy Father, Adonai, Allah, multiple gods, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, or the God, small g, in all of us. And even though they are all interconnected, each religion has its own distinct set of rules and rituals that were supposedly mandated by God, but really have more to do with the social, economic, or political climate at the time." Then he would go on about how this powerful Jewish leader raised sheep and was at odds with the pig farmer down the river, which may or may not have had something to do with the designation of pigs as treif, or unclean. Of course he would say this as he joyfully bit into a bacon-wrapped shrimp or some other equally verboten delicacy. Like so much of Dad's new life, his interest in Buddhism really grew out of his relationship with Erica, who, as a young adult, had immersed herself in the study and practice of Zen meditation. In his ever-present quest for knowledge and commitment to self-examination, Dad connected deeply with the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism. All existence is suffering. The cause of suffering is desire. Freedom from suffering is achieved through the elimination of desire. Elimination of desire and suffering can be reached through the Eightfold Path. Right understanding, right intent, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. In a conversation with Rainn Wilson for his Soul Pancake series, he elaborated, "We're suffering beings. It's our nature. We suffer from the want of what we don't have, the fear of losing what we do have. We are engaged in this process for the rest of our lives, and there's no ending until our last breath." He often talked about professional success as a sort of wake-up call. "Okay, I've achieved all of these great things, and guess what? It's still not enough. So there must be more to life than money, power, and fame. But what?" It was this search for something more that led him aptly to Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. In it, Frankl, a psychiatrist, recounts his experience in Auschwitz during World War II and uses that experience to introduce his theory of logotherapy. Basically, an approach to psychoanalysis that focuses on finding and pursuing meaning in one's life. This really resonated with my dad and seemed to synthesize perfectly with the teachings of Buddhism. Many paths to enlightenment, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, I mean that blah, blah, blah in the most respectful way possible. To help the spiritually challenged, like myself, Dad came up with the 5-Minute Buddhist, a short guide to Buddhism which he had printed, laminated, and folded like a takeout menu, ready to hand out to anyone who expressed an interest. You can actually find the 5-Minute Buddhist online. As with everything else, I teased him, lovingly, about his earnest proselytizing. "What are you, some kind of Buddhist missionary now? Are you going to start hanging out at the airport, handing out your little pamphlets?" "Nah, I'm not trying to convert anyone. It's just my compulsive need to share knowledge running up against my aversion to explaining the same thing over and over again." Well, that I can relate to. "Ooh, my little cynic. Look, even if one person out of 100 finds something in here that helps them live a better life or is moved to act out of compassion for someone else, then, hey, why not, right? Paper's cheap." "Yeah, but the laminating." Even though he had left education behind as a career, things like the 5-Minute Buddhist and the deep underlying messages in many of his later films indicate to me that he never really lost his desire to teach. He so enjoyed the process of puzzling out his beliefs, learning the history, reading the experts, engaging with other deep-thinking people in his life, that once he arrived at the idea that worked for him, in this case, a spiritual and psychological philosophy that compels the discovery, creation of meaning in one's life, he couldn't help but want to share it with as many people as possible. Dad's Buddhist cred was cinched the first time he and Erica had the opportunity to meet the Dalai Lama in Washington, D.C. in 2005. After attending His Holiness's public speech the previous day, they were able to spend 15 minutes with him in his suite at the Four Seasons. Wait, Dad, the Dalai Lama stays at the Four Seasons? Yep, great room, too. They saw him again in 2007 when Erica helped produce part of a Dalai Lama event at Chicago's Millennium Park. My dad described both of these meetings as profound and uplifting and felt very fortunate to have spent even a few minutes in such an amazing presence. Still, his beloved Buddhism had its limits, and my dad certainly never stopped desiring and enjoying his earthly pleasures. When he took to wearing a string of meditation beads around his wrist, he told people he was on a Buddhist diet and that the beads reminded him not to eat too much, though he added, "They get in the way when I'm cutting my steak, so I take them off for meals." While it would be easy to write this off as a casual one-liner, I think it actually speaks to my dad's postmodern take on the theories and principles that guided his beliefs. Rather than blindly accept any one religion or philosophy in its entirety, he plucked the bits and pieces that resonated with him and constructed his own ideological framework. For example, in a speech he made for the Eitz Chaim congregation on Jews and creativity, available on YouTube if you're interested, he wove together classic biblical stories, Adam and Eve, Noah's Ark, Abraham, Moses, etc., with Confucianism, Buddhism, Rodney Dangerfield, Chagall, Cinderella, and the Jewish media mafia. His point in this particular speech, but also in life, was that while there is something inherently creative at the heart of Judaism, creativity is not exclusive to Judaism, and nothing exists in a vacuum. In the same way that his approach to comedy may have felt specifically Jewish to him, it appealed to everyone precisely because it tapped into the universal themes that cut through religious and cultural differences. His ability to see the big picture, alongside his skill in making connections between seemingly disparate viewpoints, was one of his greatest strengths as a filmmaker and as a person. Orange County, 2002. Written by Mike White, directed by Jake Kasdan. High school senior Sean Brumder, Colin Hanks, has his heart set on going to Stanford. When his guidance counselor accidentally sends the wrong transcript, Sean, with the help of his brother, Jack Black, and girlfriend, Skylar Fisk, takes matters into his own hands to set the record straight. I'm with Lucy, 2002. Written by Eric Pomerantz, directed by John Sherman. Lucy, Monica Potter, is ready to walk down the aisle with the man of her dreams, but which one of the five blind dates she recalls? The sexy playwright, Gael Garcia Bernal, the cocky baseball player, Anthony LaPaglia, the nerdy store owner, Henry Thomas, the handsome physical therapist, David Boreanaz, or the shy doctor, John Hannah, will turn out to be Mr. Right. Although my dad did some acting over the years, with big roles in Baby Boom and Stealing Home, and smaller parts in Airheads, Love Affair, As Good As It Gets, Walk Hard, and The Last Kiss, to me, he generally did not seem as comfortable in front of the camera as he did behind it. Jake Kasdan, who directed Orange County, is an old family friend, and knew when he got the green light for the film that he wanted my dad to be a part of it. My dad loved the Orange County script and was really excited to work with Jake in his role as the college admissions dean. When he described the film to me and explained that his character accidentally takes several hits of MDMA, I asked, "So, do you want me to get you some ecstasy for research purposes?" "I don't think so, my baby," he laughed, "but thank you. I've heard it's like a mix of LSD and speed, and as you know, I researched both of those extensively back in my youth, so I should be okay." It was on the set of Orange County that my dad first met Jack Black, who would later star in Year One. They hit it off right away, bonding over their shared love of music and my dad's affection for Jack's band, Tenacious D. My dad liked his creature comforts, but was not a diva when it came to being part of someone else's project. Sadly, my grandmother Ruth passed away the night before my dad's last day of filming on Orange County. But he went ahead with the workday as planned because he knew how difficult it would be to reschedule the day. The one request he did make of Jake was to change the scene in which his character went down on the male lead. I didn't want to be walking down the street and have school buses of kids rolling by and shouting, "Hey, blowjob guy." In the end, he was happy with the work he did on Orange County, and I, as always, love how his real personality shone through his character, even in a totally ridiculous situation. We would often make each other laugh in the years to follow by repeating his line, "Sean, you're the same height as me. That is neat." I was very pregnant with Keon in the summer of 2002 when Dad did about a week of work on I'm with Lucy, playing Monica Potter's father opposite Julie Christie, which he was very excited about. He liked Monica a lot and really bonded with Anthony LaPaglia, who he later cast and analyzed that. It was fun to hang out on set with him in Central Park. I remember joking that he should make the most of the father of the bride scene because I would probably never get married. Even though my dad always saw acting as the weakest link in his creative chain, he seemed to revel in the novelty of the attention he got from being in front of the camera rather than behind it. The only role I know of that he ever submitted himself for was a part in the Coen brothers' A Serious Man, which he didn't get. As he got older, his self-consciousness about his appearance probably prevented him from creating and seeking out more opportunities to act, but when asked, he was more than happy to oblige. Do good. A lot of my dad's advice about life, as an adult, did not seem very practical. Go stand next to the smartest person in the room. Be in the right place at the right time. Do what makes you happy and the rest will follow. Be great at what you're doing and the right people will notice, etc. Given the serendipitous nature of his own success, I understand that this perspective came out of his own experience, but it wasn't something that could be easily replicated. Sometimes I wish he'd told me about things like what kind of jobs make good money, living within your means, how to balance realism and expectations, or tips to avoid getting stuck in a rut. After about a year and a half of my being a full-time mom, I started to think more seriously about what I wanted to do as a career. "You're lucky," my dad said. "We've been more than happy to give you a financial safety net. But it's not a hammock for you to just lay around in, so it's time to get up and get out there." Even though he said this in the nicest, gentlest way, I panicked. What was I going to do? I didn't want to go back to teaching because I worried about having enough energy and patience to deal with kids all day and then come home and still be good for my own kid. I had also been frustrated by the limits of the classroom when it came to students' emotional and behavioral issues. I hated to hand these kids off to the school counselor or worse, just smile and nod at the parents every morning even though we both knew their child was struggling and needed help. I knew I wanted to be in a helping profession but wasn't sure what specialty would suit me best. I looked at a few different options, psychology, art therapy, and eventually decided that social work would offer the most flexibility in terms of jobs. I was concerned about not making enough money as a social worker to support myself in New York, but my dad reassured me that this should not be the deciding factor in my choice. "Listen, I do what I do because I like it, but also because it gives us all the luxury to have the kind of lives we want. I want you to be happy and productive and engaged with the world. And if that means subsidizing your income, so be it. You're doing the good karmic work for all of us." So with my dad's generous emotional and financial support, I entered the master's program for social work at Yeshiva University in 2004. Going to Yeshiva was a bizarre experience. The graduate program is actually only 50% Jewish, but the majority of those are Orthodox, and to them, even though I am 100% Ashkenazi, I might as well have been a deacon in a Southern Baptist church. I loved sitting in the lounge between classes, listening to groups of wigged 22-year-old girls talking about the trials of finding a good match, cue the yenta, or how wearing skirts over their sweatpants at the gym made it hard to use certain weight machines. I did not love being in classes with people who seemed to have no business going into the profession of social work, who said things like, "Why should illegal aliens get government services?" or, "Insert horrible thing never happens in my community," or, "I don't know why we need to take cultural competency courses. I'm not going to work with any of those people." Hearing these kind of statements, my heart would start pounding and I would get so angry I'd be shaking, too afraid of losing control of my emotions to say anything. "So speak up," my dad said when I called him one night after a particularly challenging class. You never have a problem telling me when I'm wrong. Well, you're hardly ever wrong, I laughed. Plus, I know I'm not going to change the way they think, so what's the point? The point is, it's your duty as a human being to do the right thing. Jewish orthodoxy is no different from Islamic or Christian fundamentalism, and people need to hear opinions outside of their bubbles. Rabbi Kula said that fundamentalism has a way of making God very small. Does God care more about your clothing choices than he does about thousands of people starving or being tortured? Are you familiar with the phrase tikkun olam? Yes, Rabbi, repair the world, I know, I teased. But it seems like they're only interested in tikkuning their own olam, and I don't know enough to make any religious arguments against their ignorance. Tikkuning their own olam, he repeated, chuckling. You're a funny girl. Did you know that? Well, I think it runs in the family. The next day, I met with one of my professors and explained the problem. He helped me come up with a scripted response that I still use today. I'm having a strong reaction to what you just said. Can you clarify your point so I can make sure I understand? Listen. It seems like you may not be aware that what you're saying is rooted in racism, sexism, homophobia, xenophobia, etc. Are you interested in having a conversation about that? Yes? Great. No? Well then, please know that your comments come across as highly ignorant and offensive. My field work during the three-year program consisted of community organizing for a corrupt city council member in Washington Heights, running support groups for teens in an after-school program of the Harlem Children's Zone, and doing individual counseling and Medicare enrollment for seniors at a nursing home. Although these were all amazing learning experiences on many levels, none of them were exactly the type of work I wanted to do. I ended up landing the perfect job on the first interview I went on after graduation, maternity NICU social worker at Metropolitan Hospital Center. Over the next few years, I worked with hundreds of pregnant and postpartum women, providing assessment, counseling, and referrals to other agencies as they dealt with the full spectrum of perinatal and life issues. Because MET was a public hospital, part of the New York City Health and Hospitals Corporation system, every patient was considered high risk. That meant that even the least complicated cases usually involved women with extremely limited financial resources and very little social support. Apart from the most basic manifestations of poverty, crowded living conditions and poorly maintained housing, no money to buy baby supplies, many of the patients also suffered from severe depression and anxiety, particularly the large population of immigrant women who had often left their entire families behind in their home countries to come to the United States to work. And those were the easy cases. Issues around domestic violence, sexual abuse, drug addiction, homelessness, severe medical conditions, mental illness, and fetal demise rounded out my caseload. It was tough work, but I loved it, and at the end of even the most difficult days, my dad was always just a phone call away, ready to let me vent or make me laugh as needed. It's just so horrible and frustrating, I half-sobbed into the phone after a particularly tough day. I can bend over backwards doing everything I possibly can for these families, and in the end, it doesn't make a damn bit of difference. It's a drop in the bucket. But you're there for them, Violet, and that's important. Is it, really? This woman has the mind of a 10-year-old, had 3 other children taken away from her, the boyfriend is an asshole, she lives in a shelter, and now she's pregnant with a baby that has so many medical problems, it probably won't even survive. What can I possibly do for her? Almost nothing. God, that's sad. I know. But look, even if you can't solve her problems, treating this woman with respect and compassion is important because she probably doesn't get much of either. When I worked at the psych ward, I spent a whole weekend on suicide watch with this woman. On Monday, the doctors cleared her to leave and she smiled at me over her shoulder as she walked out the door. I was so naive, I thought, well, I really helped her. The next day, they told me she'd slit her wrists as soon as her husband went to work. I felt awful, of course, but as time wore on, I realized that sometimes just being a point of light on someone's path, wherever it takes them, is all you can do. And it may not be much, but at least it's something. And I'm really proud of you, whatever that's worth. I continued doing this type of work for the next 8 years. Sometimes I was actually able to help people, and sometimes I felt like I was sending people out the door with a band-aid on a broken leg. Either way, my dad's words hit home and were a source of comfort to me on the difficult days, even after he was gone. Nerd alert. My dad loved words. He did the New York Times crossword puzzle daily in ink for as long as I can remember. Monday puzzles took him about 10 minutes. Saturday and Sunday, 30 minutes tops. He obsessively played an anagram game on his handheld digital dictionary and would happily discuss the origins of this word or that, or educate you on the world's longest palindrome. He was also very creative with his swearing, coming up with profane hybrids to fit whatever frustrating situation he was in. "You shirt fuck," he once growled at his suitcase as he packed and one shirt refused to lie flat. "Water fucker asshole," he'd yell at the sink when the faucet sprayed all over him. In all seriousness, though, he knew the answer to almost every question on Jeopardy and had deep knowledge of a variety of subjects ranging from anti-disestablishmentarianism to the global cultural history of the zither. When I would tell him how smart he was, he'd say, "Nah, I've just been around for a long time." But it was more than that. He had an amazing memory. He could tell you the name of every teacher he ever had and what their quirks were. He had an ear for languages and over the years had picked up enough Yiddish, German, Russian, Greek, and French to have charming and pointless conversations wherever he went. Fans and friends alike were delighted to be greeted with little gems in their own languages. He devoured knowledge as if it were a rack of lamb, reading voraciously and then finding practical and fascinating ways to work any new information into his everyday conversations. The nonfiction he read, Guns, Germs, and Steel, Quest for Identity, A History of God, Man's Search for Meaning, A Distant Mirror, A Brief History of Time, sat by his bedside next to the storytellers he loved. Paul Bowles, Philip Roth, Paul Auster, Jonathan Lethem, David Sedaris. These were his Bibles. He had been educated in the Chicago public school system of the 1950s, and while there may not have been a lot of critical thinking going on, he'd read all the classics, knew U.S. history backward and forward, had memorized the periodic table, and could diagram a sentence like nobody's business. Because of his work, Dad had the opportunity to meet and become friends with some of the filmmakers, artists, and writers he admired so deeply, and he wasn't shy about expressing his enthusiasm for their talent. In an email he sent to Richard Russo, my dad shared how much he had enjoyed his latest novel. June 23, 2009. Subject: That Old Cape Magic. Rick. I got the advance copy of the book and took it with me to Nantucket this weekend for the film festival. Strange coincidence to be reading it as we flew over the Cape. I finished it this morning sitting in bed with Erica and burst into tears at the end. I might have said this to you before, but I don't think anyone writes about marriage, especially long marriages, with more insight, wisdom, or compassion. These issues of grief and isolation are recurring themes in my life, and judging from the kind of sitcom banter I hear between other couples we know, I am not alone in this. I don't know to what extent your writing reflects your own experience, but I do know that it takes courage to speak the complicated truth about love and loss in committed relationships. I recently read Philip Roth's Exit Ghost, and I know he'd make the deconstructionist argument that the real facts of your own marriage have nothing to do with the text, but I feel like you've been there, and that thought somehow comforts me. As I race through my mid-60s, life is getting steadily easier socially and professionally, and more complicated, ambiguous, and poignant on the personal and family front. You're my hero, punched in the face, rear-ended by karma, and man enough to keep coming back. Okay, one proofreading note. On page 192, last sentence of the middle paragraph, heal, H-E-A-L, where it should be heal, H-E-E-L. Congratulations. Harold. More thoughtful than just your average fan letter, this correspondence illustrates both how comfortable my dad was sharing his personal connections to Russo's work and how, even when swept away by a compelling narrative, he still maintained a sharp eye toward copy editing. In fact, Dad once received a fan letter that was so poorly written, he corrected the grammatical errors in red pen and sent it back. Afterward, he felt badly about it, but was ultimately vindicated when, years later, the fan approached him on the street and told him that receiving the corrected letter had been humiliating, but also pushed him to go back to school and ultimately changed the course of his life. In my mind, there was nothing my dad didn't know. In 2004, after watching 14-year-old David Tidmarsh win the national spelling bee with the word autochthonous, I bragged to my friends that even though none of us had ever heard this word before or had any idea what it meant, my dad definitely would. "No way," they said. "Call him now." I got on the phone and told him the word. "Nope," he said. "No idea." "Well, you've disgraced our family name," I joked. "Oy, sorry, my baby. I'll do better next time." My shame, of course, was feigned, but I was actually shocked that there was a word out there that my father didn't know. His scope was that broad, and his knowledge was just that deep. Sister Act. One day, in the spring of 2004, my dad called. His voice sounded slightly off, maybe a little forced, as he broke the news. "I heard from Amy Heckerling." "Oh, really?" I made sure to keep my tone casual and calm, even though my stomach lurched a little. "What did she say?" "She said that Molly knows everything and wants to meet me." "Really? Wow. How do you feel about that?" I don't know. Nervous? Excited?" "I bet." "She goes to NYU and they have an apartment on the Upper West Side." "That's crazy. What if she's like my next door neighbor?" "Well, we'll find out. I'm thinking I'll meet her when we're in town next month on the way to the vineyard." "Yikes. Okay. I'm gonna talk to her on the phone later this week." "Are you okay with this? Does it freak you out?" Not really. I thought it would, but Erica's kind of freaked out." "Really? Why?" "Oh, I think she's worried about the potential for disaster." "What's new?" I laughed. "They don't want anything from you, though, right? It's not going to be a big dramatic scene, is it? She just wants to meet?" "I think so. That's what Amy said." "We'll see. Oh, my God, I hope it isn't a total disaster." "It won't be," I reassured him. In truth, I had no idea if it would be a disaster or not, but I wasn't used to seeing my dad so out of sorts, and I wanted to give him the same comfort and confidence that he'd always given me. Phone calls happened, arrangements were made. The plan was for all of us to meet her and say hi, and then Molly and Dad would go alone to have coffee and talk, while Amy, Erica, Julian, then 14, Daniel, then 10, toddler Keon, and I would have lunch and wait for them. If things went well, we could all go back to my apartment. If they didn't, we'd go our separate ways. Dad was so nervous, blinky and compulsively adjusting his shirt. Erica kept squeezing my arm and saying, "I can't believe this is happening." I can only imagine the excitement, worry, and anticipation they were feeling because I felt nothing. Disassociated. In other words, my default mode for when other people are emotional. Molly and Amy walked up to us on Broadway and introductions were made. I greeted Molly warmly and we awkwardly embraced. She was 18, in a flowery dress and army jacket, with long red hair and my dad's face. Amy was petite and pale and looked like a rock star who had just rolled out of bed. Dad and Molly went off to French Roast, while the rest of us went to Artie's Deli. Amy and Erica chatted and drank iced tea while the boys ate bagels and I wrangled Keon. After about an hour, Dad and Molly walked in smiling and we all went back to my apartment to hang out. What I remember most about that first day is how Molly seemed so similar to us and yet so different at the same time. Physically, there was an undeniable resemblance. I mean, she looked even more like my dad than I did, fiery red hair notwithstanding. In fact, seeing her made me realize how much of my looks had come from my mother. But where nature ends and nurture takes over, Molly was like a stranger. Her vibe, cadence, and timing were so different from ours. Granted, it was an overwhelming day for her, but she seemed shy and hesitant in a way I hadn't anticipated. I could tell she was funny, and we kept trying to connect, but I felt like we were just always a beat off from really clicking. Mostly, though, I was just relieved that it seemed to be a drama-free encounter. As we wrapped up the evening, she and I exchanged phone numbers and said we'd get together soon. Of course, after Molly and Amy left, we grilled my dad on how their conversation had gone. "I think it was good," he vocal fried. "It all just feels so big." "Okay, just give us the nutshell," I nudged. Well, she wanted to know the story from my perspective. I told her, and she seemed okay with it. She told me how it was for her to find out, and I don't know. I apologized. For what? For not having been there for her. It seemed like the right thing to do at the time, but who knows? Right for me, but maybe not for her. Well, it seemed like she turned out pretty well in spite of it all, though, no? Oh, yeah, she did just fine without me. She's smart, she's funny, she writes, but still. It's big, my baby, big, big, big. A few months later, Dad was in New York alone and asked me if I wanted to go to Molly's birthday party with him. We went to someone's apartment downtown and smoked pot with some people on the roof. I, not knowing who knew what, mistakenly introduced myself to a young woman as Molly's sister. She was immediately taken aback. What? I'm her cousin. How is that possible? Oops. Molly was tough to read, but tried to reassure me it was okay. I felt bad about possibly messing things up for Molly with her family, but I was also confused. Now that we all knew each other, weren't things going to be out in the open? Apparently not, as there were still strong feelings and issues to be resolved in this complicated situation. Still ongoing, issues around the truth of Molly's paternity led her to being cut off by some members of her family. This is, in part, why I've chosen to reveal this long-held secret and claim Molly officially, with her consent, of course, as one of us. I know my dad would have stepped up and done the same if he were here. Molly and I didn't talk for almost 2 years after that. Not because we didn't want to, but just because we were both lazy flakes. She and my dad spoke and emailed from time to time, but didn't seem to develop a steady rhythm with each other. He always spoke about her with a kind of wistfulness that I found heartbreaking. I know he was the bad guy in their scenario. That wasn't a position he was often in, and it weighed on him. About 5 years after our initial meeting, Molly came over to my apartment. We got stoned, clicked, hallelujah, and started to have a real relationship of our own. She was hilarious and creative and ballsy, and we were amazed at all of the overlap in our personalities and upbringing, despite the differences. Now, I may be partial to oddly neurotic Jewish girls who say fuck a lot and aren't afraid of a good Holocaust joke, but she was like a dream come true. Actually, I had never met anyone like her, and I was kind of in love. She came over every Tuesday night for the next year, and we became really close. My kids loved her because she made dirty jokes and laughed at their shenanigans. One night, as she watched me wage full-scale bedtime warfare against my two little rebels, she laughed into her beer bottle as I finally closed their bedroom door and tiptoed back into the living room. We'd just started talking when, out of nowhere, she flipped me the bird. "Did you just give me the finger?" I asked, mock incredulously. "No, Kian is behind you making faces and being a little shit," she laughed. "Oh," I said, grinning from ear to ear. "Well then, that's fine." The parallels and contrasts between Molly and myself would make for a great psychological study, or at the very least, an interesting episode of Separated at Birth. We grew up in similarly unusual Hollywood families, so our frames of reference line up almost identically. However, whereas I'm confident but shy, she struggles with low self-esteem but is very brave. She was the lead singer in a rock band for several years and is now writing scripts, making puppets, and doing stand-up comedy. Badass, right? Our mutual admiration for each other, "You're amazing, no, you're amazing," allowed us to get close without it ever feeling competitive. Ironically, in 2004, another sister joined the family when Ida Wandamu came from Ethiopia to stay with Dad and company and attend Julian and Daniel's private school. Ida, 15 and entering her sophomore year, had researched schools and contacted the admissions department on her own, outside of any established exchange program. They in turn reached out to my family, who agreed to host her. For the first year she lived with Dad and Erica, Ida pretty much ate only meat and chocolate, separately of course, and read romance novels obsessively. I think she clung to these familiar things because the adjustment to a totally new life was so overwhelming. Over time she expanded her tastes, in both food and reading, and she thrived socially and academically at school. Amazingly, despite the differences in background, she fit right in with the family and all of our Michigas. Ida, Julian, and Daniel lived as siblings and were very close. Ida and I liked each other from the start, but both felt a little threatened nonetheless. She stayed in what had originally been my room in the Glencoe house and seemed to fulfill all of my dad's daughterly requirements. Funny, sweet, intellectual, creative. Was this the other daughter I should have been worrying about instead of Molly? Thankfully, no. As it turned out, whatever concerns I had were totally unfounded. My dad adored Ida and Molly, but there was plenty of love to go around. What was supposed to have been a 1-year stay stretched into 2, then 3, and Ida graduated from North Shore Country Day in 2007. She then went on to Tufts, where she double majored in international affairs and French literature, receiving her BA with honors in 2011. We remained her home base through college, Dad, Erica, and the boys in Chicago, me and my brood in New York. Ida did a few rotations of relief work in the Philippines and Uganda before eventually getting her master's in international affairs from Johns Hopkins. She is now working at an NGO refugee camp in South Sudan. We all talk to her regularly and are hopeful that she will be able to return to her second home and us, her second family, soon. Far from where I started as a lonely only child, the big jumbled mess of our family now includes 5 siblings connected in various ways by DNA, shared history, choice, and most important, love. Julian, Daniel, Molly, Ida, and I may not all share the traditional bonds of parentage or the experience of growing up under the same roof, but we are deeply and undeniably connected, and I value the relationships I have with all of them beyond anything I could ever have imagined. Even though he's not here with us, I know that my dad, always the proud patriarch, is beaming at us, his beautiful mess of a family, from wherever he is. The Ice Harvest, 2005. Written by Richard Russo and Robert Benton. Based on the novel by Scott Phillips. Directed by Harold Ramis. Mob attorney Charlie Arglist, John Cusack, plays by his own rules. When he and Vic, Billy Bob Thornton, decide to steal money from the big boss, Randy Quaid, their plans to leave town fall apart when an ice storm sweeps through the area on Christmas Eve. Charlie. It's Christmas. Everyone's nice on Christmas. Vic. Only morons are nice on Christmas. Ramis is at his best when dealing with men facing a soul-defining crisis, and he finds plenty to work with in Russo and Benton's script, which offers Russo's trademark blend of colorful characters and slow-building dilemmas. The Ice Harvest finds them all operating in top form in as dark a territory as they've ever explored. Keith Phipps, AV Club. There is very little fun in The Ice Harvest, which wouldn't pose a problem if the film had some fleshed-out ideas to go along with the booze, the booty, and the recycled plot points. As expected from a Harold Ramis film, there are some nice comedy bits mixed into Charlie's exchanges with friend, foe, and family member. It's too bad that these bits are so few and far between. Manola Dargis, The New York Times. The Ice Harvest was my dad's foray into darker, lower-budget waters. The script, based on a Scott Phillips novel, came to him via his agent at UTA, and he and his producing partner, Laurel Ward, knew right away that they wanted to make the movie. Dad had been a fan of Richard Russo and Robert Benton, and the story dealt with one of his favorite subjects, existentialism. My dad was drawn to the construct of these characters, who had seemingly lost all sense of meaning and chose lives of vice and violence over the bland dissatisfaction of the American dream. He likened it to men who stop at bars on their way home from work and then eventually just stop going home. In one scene, Charlie, John Cusack, talks about his father and uncle, fraternal twins who lived opposite lives and died one day apart. You do one thing, you do another, I mean, so what? What's the difference? Same result. This dialogue points to a much bleaker outlook than was the norm for my dad, but he connected with the material and felt the film had something important to say. Less profound but more fun was the fact that he spent several days auditioning exotic dancers for the various club scenes in the movie. He called me one evening from his car after a long day of watching strippers shimmy up and down a pole and said, "I saw about 30 naked and amazingly athletic women today. I don't know how they do it. Do I have the best job in the world or what?" The book and the original script ended with the John Cusack character Charlie dying, but the test audiences were not happy with that. People were really loving the movie, laughing in all the right places, but then, as soon as Charlie died, it was like all the air got sucked out of the room, he told me. I think Laurel actually threw up. Apparently, people weren't ready to embrace the ultimate existential ending, death. One of the response cards even said,